Well, hi, everybody, and welcome to the Cultural Studies podcast. My name is Toby Miller, and my guest today is
Lisa Funnell. I'm the Associate Dean of Creative Industries at Mohawk College in Canada.
And during your time living in North America, Prof, have you had to deal with being called Funnell more than Funnell?
Absolutely. Most people ask me how to say my last name. And if you go way back, it's Funnell. We just called ourselves Funnell, but I answer to both.
No, I mean, to me, it's an interesting question because the very English pronunciation would be funnel, I think it's fair to say. But lots of other places have the emphasis on the other syllable, right? So
And
anyway.
I've had people, when they know that my mom is Italian from Italy, they're like, Funnelli? And I'm like, no, my dad's family was from Britain and it's funnel. They try to read into my name.
I love it. So, Prof, I wanted to, oh my God, there's a man on the roof opposite taking off his clothes. That's disgusting. So far, it's only the t-shirt. Let's hope it stays there. Oh, he's not exactly a fine figure of a chap either. Anyway,
Oh my gosh.
Prof, to kick things off. And now he's waving the t-shirt around like it's a flag. Or he's putting it over his head, protection from the sun.
Okay.
But this does expose his
The
torso.
rest of his body?
I don't know what's going on. I'm not sure this meets Justin Trudeau's standards for cancer prevention for Canadians.
Maybe they're thinking, you know, their head they're trying to protect from the sun, because sometimes people don't realize you can definitely burn your scalp. So maybe
Yes.
it's a balance thing.
Absolutely. Absolutely. As my dermatologist when I was living in Mexico said to me on our first encounter, you have a very damaged face.
So kind.
So, Prof, now that he's stopped disrobing and is now sitting down on the roof that his colleague is working on, we can get back to why we're actually here today, which is to learn about your research. But to start by asking you, what's currently dynamizing, retarding, preoccupying, interesting you?
Well, besides the man on the roof without a shirt, I don't know. It's one of those things where I feel as though as an academic, as a scholar, we're constantly thinking and engaging, right? I feel as though when I do my work, I have to go into such a higher place or plane of thinking. Sometimes I'll look at my own work and be like, wow, that's really great, and not realizing that I wrote it. And so when I come down from that moment, it's kind of nice not to be thinking about anything. I think we need to give ourselves that moment of relief. And if anybody listening struggles with anxiety, you know the blissful relief of not thinking about anything, not having anything affecting you mentally, emotionally. And I really do try to bring myself to that type of a state, whether I can do that myself or I listen to a lot of like crime audiobooks where I can turn off and teach myself how to turn off that inner voice. So it's nice to not be thinking about anything other than you at the moment.
And what have you got any tips for crime audiobooks that you'd recommend to us at the moment?
Oh my goodness, I'd have to go through my Amazon library. My genre of choice are sort of crime thrillers written by women about women and voiced by women. And I find that they tend to almost like reduce down some of the sexual violence, kind of the patriarchy or the misogyny that can be read into. I find it a little bit disconcerting to sometimes read about prostitutes and sex and sometimes the ways that men present that. Whereas I find that when women are cultivating these narratives, you get a very different experience. There's more of a focus in on survivors or the lived experience, or a playing down of what I would consider to be really traumatic or trauma-inducing content. And I'd like to steer away from that. I'm good with just like the plain old murder. And then trying to be the detective, working through.
Kim Sherwood.
Yes.
What's your take?
I haven't I haven't read her books yet. I've had many people say, "Hey, Lisa, what is your take?" And here's the thing. This is going to sound so bad as a researcher, and maybe no one will ever have me on a podcast again, but I hate reading. I'll write books. I will do my research begrudgingly sometimes, but I hate reading, and that's why I became a film scholar, right? Because at least half of it is watching and critiquing and thinking rather than poring over written text. And so I keep pushing and kicking that can down the path.
Well, sorry, I apologize. I interrupted. Go
No,
ahead.
the expectation is that I'm going to have something to say about it, and I have to be in a place to actually read it where I feel the pressure where I have to have something to say. So I want to be in the right headspace to read it, whereas it's work for me rather than just pleasure.
Pleasure. And I didn't. I was assuming that her books already had audio versions. Actually,
Do
when
they?
I don't know. I have no idea. Why don't I look that up?
Look that up for me.
While we're chatting, Kim Sherwood Audio. Let's see. Audible.com, but I'm just going to look her up on Audible.com, which I don't use, but yes. Yes. Double or Nothing. At least in Spanish. I don't know whether it's in English. So one
My
novel is
Spanish isn't
available.
good.
One novel is available on audio. No
Okay.
pressure. No pressure.
No pressure.
No pressure. No,
But
the
within the
reason
last week, I've had two people email me on Instagram being like, "So what do you think? What do you think?" And I'm like, "I don't think."
the reason I wanted to ask you, Prof, is that one of the areas in which you work is James Bond and women in James Bond. Another area is transnational, including Chinese cinema. Another area is Me Too and Hollywood rape culture. And I'm hoping we can talk about more of those things. But one of the qualities, in my opinion, of Kim Sherwood, and I've read the first of her trilogy, and I'm partway through the second, is A. She has, and you may already know this, lots of people of color. She has people who are cognitively divergent or diverse. And she writes in a way that is literary in a good sense, I think, without losing the good yarn. And in the first James Bond novel she wrote, he has no dialogue. So I think she's very interesting and a terrific writer, given that it's genre fiction. Anyway, I apologize for sort of outing you, as it were. I just,
Non-reader.
I, no, no, fair enough. I just figured that if I figured her books would be on audio and that you'd probably listen to them. So there we go. Anyway, I do think she's at least interesting.
Beautiful. I'm
And
good with recommendations, so.
on audiobooks, could you tell us about that? Because I know some people like books that are read by the authors or poetry read by the poet. Some like particular kinds of accents. What's your thing with the audiobook? Mostly crime fiction, mostly written by gals rather than boys. Yeah.
Yeah, so I started listening to audiobooks during the pandemic, and at the time I was living alone in Oklahoma and with my dog, but in my house, right? My echoey house. And I found that I needed another voice in my space. I needed to feel that sense of connection. I'd have to go through my list, but what I love about the women voice artists is the fact that their voices are believable across genders, where sometimes men who are voice artists, I don't buy into the way that they represent women necessarily. It tends to just be a different pitch, a different tone. I can sense an artifice, whereas I'm always impressed by the women as they're performing different voices, different impressions, to the point that sometimes I forget that it's a single person reading the book. And I always marvel at the fact that if there's multiple characters that the single person, and again, I don't know how they record it, right? I'm assuming they're just sitting there reading it in one sitting, but just impressed with the way that they're able to shift their voices to all these different types and styles, then put the emotions in and emote in such a way that I am being captivated by what they're saying. I'm being drawn in. I'm very action oriented. So that's why I like these books, because they're very action oriented. They're not necessarily deep, introspective, and descriptive, and they're moving from piece to piece, but they're able to punctuate it with these emotions, and they're doing it solely by voice. And it's the need that I had, and I still, I guess, continue to have for that emotion to be just flowing through me instead of it being my emotions. Again, you know, anybody with anxiety kind of knows there's lots of emotions that are there. It's other types of emotions that I get to participate in, I get to process. But then when the book's done, those emotions go with it, right? I don't have to harbor those emotions. And sometimes I finish a book and it's great, but I couldn't tell you what it was about. Because it's just one of those things where it helps me to just stay emotionally calibrated, in ways that we're in a society right now that's all over the place. There's so much to think and so much to feel that I need help. And it's these voices, and I use Audible. So these voices on Audible, that I'm able to connect with. And I like the fact that I'm purchasing their books, that I am helping these authors make money and these performers continue to perform. I believe in buying in and contributing in. And as somebody who studied Hong Kong cinema and looked at the impact of piracy on, you know, the Hong Kong film industry, it's to me, it's just very important to pay for the media that I'm consuming. Because it does matter, and it does matter to those who are not maybe these, you know, sort of the top of the top in terms of bestsellers. They too also need money, and I want them to continue moving forward with their craft. So for me, it's just, I don't know if it's cultural responsibility, but it's that notion of me supporting through my readership and of course leaving reviews, and they're honest reviews, but they're probably going to be positive reviews so that others can know that this is something that they should be reading.
Prof, that seems like a good point for us to move on to Hong Kong work that you've done.
Yeah.
And could you share with us some of that? And my recollection is that your interest in Bond was a route into that. Am I right in saying so?
You are 100% right. And I'd love to give a shout out to the amazing Michelle Yeoh for being my anchor to Hong Kong cinema. I remember I was doing my master's thesis on the Bond girl phenomenon. I had never seen Tomorrow Never Dies for some reason, just wasn't on my radar. And I was doing this quantitative content analysis, and I don't do much quantitative work. So it was just for my master's thesis. And I remember seeing her on screen, and I stopped taking notes. And I was just mesmerized by what she was doing on screen, and seeing the corporal authenticity, seeing her performing many of these stunts, and wondering, where are you from? How did you learn how to do this? Why isn't the media that I'm consuming here the same? And it took me to my dissertation, which was on, you know, transnational Chinese warrior women. And Michelle Yeoh's on the cover. She's one of many that I studied. But I wanted to learn more about different cinema systems and the way that women and women's narratives were being represented, but specifically in a genre that has long been dominated by men. So how do women carve out cinematic and cultural space? What do their performances mean? How are they transgressing boundaries and narratives? And if you look at someone like Michelle Yeoh, who is my favorite star, and as an aside, I'm working on a new collection about Michelle Yeoh that, you know, it right now the proposal, we submitted it, it's under review. We're very excited about it. But it's something that I look at her and her life and all the barriers she's overcome. And they always say, don't meet your heroes. I would love to meet her. I have so much respect for her as a woman, as a performer, as someone who's broken down barriers, particularly for Chinese and Asian women on screen. And I'm really hoping that it breaks whatever that ceiling is, and we start to see more opportunities, not just for Michelle Yeoh, but for others to be able to come through in, you know, Hollywood, Western media, because it has been highly stereotypical and still remains stereotypical to this day.
So you went back from watching her in that film you mentioned, to her earlier work in Hong Kong
Oh, yeah.
as part of your research into, to use technical language, kick-ass women in that genre, in that
Oh,
world.
yeah. And they're amazing. I mean, if anybody has ever seen Yes, Madam, and I don't think there's any more print copies of it. It's one of those things you can get on the internet. The sound effects, by the way, love it. I mean, I love the old school 80s kind of cheesy sound effects. I'm 100% in. But just seeing her on screen with Cynthia Rothrock fighting and doing amazing things on screen. I don't know. I can't even describe the feeling. Like it's my stomach gets butterflies in it. It's like I start to shake. I'm moving with her. And I don't think I've ever had that experience watching a different performer where, like, you know, when your body tenses up, that is the type of impact that she's had on myself and many other people. And I'm like, I want to study that. I want to study my feeling, my reactions, and why so many of us are reacting in the same way.
And Prof, one of the things you've talked about earlier is being disturbed by the depiction of women as the victims or survivors or not of violence. What about when it's dispensed by women?
It's read differently. So I would relate it to the B word. If a woman calls me a B, that's one thing. If a man calls me a B, it's going to be a different reaction. It's just the way that our patriarchal system works. I find that historically, and this kind of goes into a lot of my Me Too work, sexual violence is utilized as some sort of story builder, as if women can't be strong without it. So victimizing and doing brutal things to women is now the catalyst for them to have revenge and be strong. We have the rape revenge subgenre there, and that's its root. What I liked about Michelle Yeoh's films and these other films is that's not the genesis, right? These women are professional women. In the case of Yes, Madam, two women kind of competing for their space in sort of this police system that is male dominated. Women competing with each other because that definitely happens, right? Competing with each other and then learning about the power of collaboration and the need to come together because we're stronger together than separated. And so enacting violence on men takes on a different tone in terms of the fighting. And then the violence with women is also kind of spectacular, but the women are on the same feet, on the same foot, socially, within sort of the system. And so it comes across as different than when there's differences in terms of gender and differences in terms of power and identity and privilege.
I remember 40 years ago when I was first encountering what were probably some of the first legal cases where women had killed abusive male partners and were either exonerated or got minor sentences by contrast with other killings because of the history of abuse and how this was seen as a breakthrough by many and quite the opposite by others, regardless of the fact that if you look at the history of incarceration around the globe, women are not incarcerated because of violence done to others. They're generally incarcerated because of drug issues or other, in inverted commas, victimless crimes. And yet there was a sort of hysterical reactionary response to these either fairly minimal sentences or exonerations. So it's an interesting one. And I find myself, when I'm watching a film, and there is anything like a stalking sequence or a point of view assumed by the camera looking at a woman, I have the sort of this reaction in my stomach that you mentioned, Re Michelle Yeoh, but not in a good way, in a bad way. I look away, I'm repulsed. And in that moment, at least in my mind, I become the woman who is the object of intended violence. It's a So I agree with you that there is a very different connotation. Though obviously it's different for me as a man, but I do think that's an interesting one. Could we move on to Me Too then?
Sure.
And you may want to make a bridge of that from the Hong Kong work and this rape story, this rape revenge story, and perhaps Me Too more broadly?
You know, I'm working on two. I published an anthology with Ralph Bellavo on Me Too in Hollywood, and we're doing one right now, almost done. The manuscript's almost done. Looking at television, you know, for me, that bridge also comes back to James Bond. So I've worked on James Bond in tandem with my work on Hong Kong cinema, Chinese warrior women. Again, Michelle Yeoh is always that link for me. Like she is, if you look at my career, she's in the center of all of these connectors, and these explanations. And I was writing a paper looking at sexual violence in the early James Bond films and the fact that the way that it was naturalized and normalized. So just like you said, feeling repulsed by being encouraged by the camera to also participate in the look, it was really trying to understand what was the perception of women, what was considered permissible, and engaging in these conversations of being able to critique what I consider to be really, really bad practices, while still maintaining fandom, which is a really difficult thing to do. And I find that I try to engage with various fans, and try to teach them that we have to have these conversations, just like we have to be able to critique patriotism, right? You can critique your own country. That doesn't mean you don't love your country. It means that you want something different and something better moving forward. Like we have to have these conversations. And so I went to Ralph. We were both teaching at OU, and I said, we need to put something out about this. He and I had had many conversations. We're very aligned. And just putting together and pulling together scholars, we found that we were overwhelmed with contributors. We were blown away by their level of engagement. The book won an award. It was listed as, you know, a choice academic, outstanding academic title. And then it led us to do a second book because we found that so many people wanted to talk about television. And with COVID and people engaging with streaming media and even reading articles about how television was considered a positive thing and was being encouraged, right? For the first time in history, people are saying, play video games and watch television. And yet there was no critique of the content, right? Of what is the impact? And it's weird because I'll sit here and I've like everyone else, I stream media and I'm like, oh, I don't want to invest in a movie that's 2 hours, but I'll binge watch 10 episodes of a show. And in my mind, I'm thinking, oh, a show is less of a commitment than that 2 hour movie. But instead, it's triple the content. I don't know, math's not my forte, but much more content, but not sitting there thinking, who's creating the content? What am I being absorbed into? What are the images and impressions? And in many senses, what is the danger of us binge watching, not thinking about what we're watching? How are we being socialized to think about gender, about power, about sexual violence, about what is okay and what isn't okay? How is that changing over time? And how are we? And I think you gave a great example when you said you feel repulsed. How are we changing? Because maybe that wasn't a way that you felt 10 years ago, 20 years ago, 30 years ago. So how has the Me Too movement and discussions of sexual violence, having people bravely come forward, describing their experiences, how is that influencing the way that we're thinking? And then how can we utilize these very brave stories, these lived experiences, these traumas? How can we push forward for a media that is a heck of a lot more responsible? Because my question is that violence necessary to our storylines? And I don't think it is. I think it's easy storytelling. I think it's lazy storytelling. And quite frankly, I think that we can do better.
And I guess one of the things about Me Too is that, along with the call for Hollywood to be more demographically inclusive when it comes
Yeah.
to Black America, the impact is meant to be dual in representational senses. Representational senses textually, but representational senses occupationally also. And the desire to have not only more stories told that have a wide array of women's roles in them, but also more opportunities for women on and off screen to tell stories. And it's still the case, I find, that when I speak to students about the Bechdel test, they really love it. It
Such a
means
low
so much to
bar.
them. Pardon?
It's such a low bar, though, when you think about it. It's so low.
I know. I know, but it's meaningful to people.
It's meaningful to
And
them, yeah.
all that is doing, for those who don't know, is looking for films and television programs where women actually speak to one another and they're not talking about dudes, right?
Yeah,
And
it's
that's
such a
really
low bar.
all it's looking for.
And so many parts of media fail at this.
Yes. And one of the nice things about it is that it's very artisanal. It doesn't look flashy or professional if you visit it. And I really like that. And people contribute to it. But it is such a low bar. And that's another point students make, even as they all go and visit it, want to know about it.
And it's interesting because even though we've had this push for Me Too and women using their voices and men using their voices and people of various genders sharing their stories, we haven't seen necessarily an increase of more diversity behind the camera, behind the scenes. And my concern is it's not about simply bringing in, say, women or racialized minorities to come in and spot shot scripts or to be have one person on the crew. That's tokenism. That's not true and genuine inclusion and integration. What we need is a diversity of participants from inception when we're creating these stories, moving all the way through. And what we need is for us to be having everyone having these conversations, because my concern is that the Me Too movement, or if you talk about sexual harassment, sexual violence, these are considered women's issues. And the second you say they're women's issues, there's this idea then it's for women to figure out, instead of understanding that it's women's issues because women are bearing the brunt of say the violence. And yet these are people issues and these are also men's issues, because who's enacting the violence? I know Jason Katz did a study. He's done many studies, and I think he argues that between 95 and 99%, couldn't tell you, but it's high 90s, of violence enacted on women comes from men. And he argues that violence against women is actually a men's issue and not a women's issue.
And, Prof, if we can turn now to the James Bond work,
Oh, yeah.
one of your studies is an audience study about women, sorry, perceptions in audiences. He's now standing up. The shirt is still well and truly tucked around the head. There's no sign of descending trousers. So I think, in terms of anxiety levels, we can both relax.
Okay,
I'm not sure whether he can relax, but you and I can. I don't think you were ever anxious about it. I was
No.
initially, though. I was certainly so, because it's in my line of sight, more or less. In this audience study, Prof, which I think you co-authored, you ask people about their views in a sense of the evolution of roles for women in James Bond films, if that's a fair way to put it. I wonder if you can still remember that piece.
Gosh. I wrote that during COVID. I don't know if I fully remember it.
Well, just imagine you're watching the Blue Jays and the announcer is saying, and the ball's gone back, back, back. So take yourself back, back, back to those days. What did people tell you about that evolution over, I guess, more getting on for 60 years of the franchise?
I think it's interesting because I think there's this notion of progress. Right? There's always this notion that because time passes, things get better. And so there is this assumption that, the women just get stronger and stronger and stronger. And I think the women of the 1990s are a good example of the strengthening of women in the Bond franchise on screen, but nobody kind of really looks past that there's been no significant women villains, that they've kind of all disappeared. And you have the disempowerment of certain women, but there is this broader perception that there's a strengthening. And I always like to go back to the women of the 1960s before the Bond girl archetype was really set in stone. And you saw a greater diversity of, I would say, representation. You had women saving Bond rather than Bond saving them. You had some, I call them delicious, but you have women villains who are challenging him, challenging patriarchal notions. So you've got someone like Fiona Volpe, who's like, I forgot your ego, Mr. Bond. You think you're going to sleep with women and we're just going to fall for you, but I'm not going to do it. And for me, I'm just like, oh my goodness, like this woman in 1965 saying this straight to Bond's face and mocking him. That's pretty interesting to me, but that's also then coupled and paired with some problematic representations of sexual violence, which at the time appeared in many other films in addition to Bond films, but that just tends to be the focus. So it's interesting. There is this broader perception of change and improvement, but in that study, if I'm remembering it correctly, there's also this pullback for gender swapping. So this notion of should Bond be played by a woman, right? And there seems to be a lot of pullback from that. I think some people would like to see in Bond, and I understand why, like to see in Bond a representation of themselves. This is a character that is incredibly privileged in every significant category, can go anywhere in the world, do anything, and is never limited based on his identity. He is basically valued for the things that he does. So if he antagonizes you, there's going to be a reaction. It's not because he's a man, right? And he can be mad, specifically in the Craig era. So I can see not wanting to change that. And I look at the baggage that Bond brings with him, you know, the sexism that comes with the Bond film, colonialism that comes with the Bond film. There's been a lot of heteronormativity. I don't know if I'd want to do a gender swap. I think it's too much baggage, and the whole conversation would be about the swap, and it wouldn't be about anything to do with the storyline. I think we can do different narratives, different stories, create new legacies and new lineages, and you can kind of attach it to Bond. You know, I think Kim Sherwood, although I haven't read the book, the brilliant thing about her work is that she's talking about different agents, right? And I would love for there to be an expanded world of Bond where we can look at what 003 is doing, what 006 is doing. Instead of constantly going back and trying to claim space on 007, I'm sure there's other interesting tales that could be told. But I'm finding that there's a real pushback at making those changes. But we also noticed that that pushback was also connected to people and their political affiliations as well, right? So where you sort of fell.
I think that's very much the case with reactionaries in the Anglo world, in both Britain and the United States. Absolute hysteria at the idea that Bond could be female, Bond could be black. Although, if you go back to television in the mid 60s, Honey West was promoted as Jane Blonde, for instance. And of course, the figure of first Mrs. Gale and then Mrs. Peel in the Avengers were figures of immense power and significance and competence, actually much more than Honey West was, who in the stills looks pretty okay and has a pet ocelot and all that, but actually sort of stands in the corner and shrieks rather a lot when trouble visits, which Mrs. Gale and Mrs. Peel never did. So it is interesting to think about these phallic women who were actually more powerful physically and more accomplished intellectually and professionally than the men that they were encountering back then, and yet this still being something that is deemed unacceptable. I mean, I feel for Idris Elba and the discourse about him. He's more or less recently said, you know, I can do without this grief. I'm not interested. And the luggage that goes with this figure, all the cultural incrustation of Bond, affects all these discussions of the prospect of commutability. What happens when you engage in commutability of the body type, even if the language and the role remain somewhat congruent? So, in all of that, Prof, what is it do you think that makes Bond of interest in a place like Canada? And I ask that because Canada is so unusual in having such a mixed heritage, a heritage of First Peoples, of Métis, of the French, of the British, and all of you living close enough to the United States that you can watch network television for free. I mean, almost the whole Canadian population is within 50 miles of the border, and parts of Canada are actually south of parts of the United States.
So I'm from Ontario, which is kind of the sort of the southern, I'm in southern Ontario. So yeah. I don't know what it is necessarily in terms of the attraction of Bond. I think Bond is a global phenomenon. And it has had an influence all across the world. And it's interesting, as an aside, I did a book with Klaus Dodds looking at global James Bond and looking at how many different individuals in cinema systems were reinterpreting James Bond, but there's flexibility in doing it outside of the franchise itself, right? I think that there's limited ability to be diverse, limited ability to really have an evolution because of the popularity and the long-standing formulaic nature. And I'm kind of worried that that's going to be the demise of the Bond franchise because of the lack of ability to really have significant evolutions. But, it's interesting being a Canadian living so close to the US, we are very aware of what's going on in the United States at all times. Politics, I lived in the States, yes, but politics, we know everything that's going on, whether it's Supreme Court cases, the election, what happens in the US is going to invariably impact us. We are the little mouse beside the big elephant, right? We are always going to be keenly aware and we are strongly impacted by culture. And unless you have Canadian content laws, so I think on our radios, there's a certain proportion of music that has to be played that has to have certain Canadian content. Other than that, we really are inundated with American media. And Bond, yes, it's a UK production, but it also has US producers and it had US influence throughout. Albert R. Broccoli, the producer, was American. And so we're kind of tied in with the US market when it comes to James Bond. And we also have our heritage and our roots in Britain, right? We are the king is our king, right? The queen was our queen. And so there still are those remnants that are there. And yeah, I don't know if I've answered your question at all. I don't know if I can speak to Canadian popularity of James Bond, but what I can tell you as an associate dean, when people look me up on LinkedIn and I'm just having, meeting partners, industry partners, other educational partners, the first thing they say is, "Can we talk about Bond?" That is my in to conversations, and I never thought that would be the case. Like it is my ticket and my key, and it doesn't matter they're male, they're female, it doesn't matter. People want to talk to me about James Bond. What are your thoughts? What about this? What about that? My faculty email me, or if I had a new faculty member saying, "I know we got to talk about stuff, but can we talk about Bond?" It tends to be just like this icebreaker. And so people are fans in a really broad sense. They're on television, like with you growing up. I don't know. I think it's been a cultural phenomenon here too.
One of the things people may not know is that Hollywood counts Canada as domestic revenue for its films, which it doesn't do for Mexico, even though they're all in North America. And I guess there is the stereo. Oh, hang on. He's put a shirt on while we were chatting. He's now got a shirt on, but also another one. They're both white, draped over his shoulders, but no headgear now. He's a strange one.
The choice. I'm
It's
just
weird.
wondering what
Where
is.
was the second shirt all that other time? Anyway, there is a stereotype of Canadians as sort of gentler, kindler Americans, versions of US people who are not so vicious. Well, ho, 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 if you're native Canadian, and so on. But also, I guess the other thing about Canadian folks is that, as you say, a unique perspective on US culture and politics, but much more knowledge of Britain than most US people have. Even
Yes.
though Britain is of diminishing significance, I guess. So thanks for that. In terms of your book on, I guess one of your newer books is about Bond around the world, right? Now, I have to confess, I haven't read it. I don't have it. Would you be prepared to give us the scoop on that?
How dare you come to it? I'm just kidding. You don't have to read any of my books. I'm the worst promotional academic out there. I'm like, you don't have to read it. I'll tell you about it. So the book was really put together. So Klaus Dodds and I have had, this is our second book together. Love working with Klaus. Big fan. He does geopolitics, popular geopolitics. I love working with people with a different perspective than what I have. I don't like echo chambers. I learn nothing from echo chambers. And we are both big fans of James Bond. And we knew that there was this anniversary for Bond. And we wanted to talk about the global impact. We talked a lot about in our first book, Geopolitics. We wanted to understand the impact. And so the book looks at, on the one hand, What is the impact of the James Bond franchise on other cinema systems? How have different individuals, different people taken this archetype, mobilized it, transformed it, basically played off the popularity of James Bond, but also given it local readings? So how has the figure of the secret agent, the spy, been transformed and utilized and mobilized? And on the other hand, the book looks at how is the globe or the world of James Bond being depicted? So, for instance, I wrote about colonial consumption, and I was talking about Honor Majesty's Secret Service, and the way that the world is depicted is really like a very like Eurocentric world. So you have all these angels of death. The vast majority of them come from Europe. Like, where is the angel of death from the continent of Africa? Where is the angel of death from the continent of South America? Like, the logistics don't actually make sense, and yet that's the way that the world is being presented. And so it's really trying to understand the way that James Bond is representing the world, because these are texts that are then being distributed around the world. And so, you know, as a Canadian, my understanding of British culture has largely been influenced by James Bond. Is it accurate? Maybe, maybe not. But I see Britain as being a strong power because of the health of James Bond and his ability to be involved in all of these other elements. And so you see the way the world is being represented and how the world has chosen to represent themselves through the archetype of James Bond. So that's kind of the book in a very neat, not neatish
Fascinating.
package.
In terms of British power, London is the biggest money laundering centre in the world by far, and Britain is the manufacturer of murderous machinery designed to kill millions. So, yes, it's got those elements of power. It also has the English language going for it, and that is a huge economic advantage. Fortunately, the imperialists have forgotten that and exiled themselves from the European Union at the same time as alienating everybody else other than other lackeys of the United States, like Australia. So they are really for the dustbin. And it's interesting, too, I think, that in terms of those uptakes of the Bond figure, you probably get them in many cinemas around the world because of something about, apart from anything else, the figure of the spy. Now, Bond doesn't do much actual spying. He pretends to be people for 5 minutes and then he's unfurled as who he really is. It's mostly kissing people and kicking people, isn't it?
So I would say the films of the 60s have a little bit more of that spy ethic to it. So you see him in his hotel room taking a piece of hair and putting it against, you know, a door and you know, trying to utilize that to tell if there's been any detection. And it's so funny because I was watching, I don't know, on social media, you get on Instagram, a video of somebody who went to a hotel and all the ways that they protect themselves from people coming in. And I thought to myself, I'm like, this should be in a Bond film. Like, this type of spy-esque elements that I've always found quite fascinating. That's kind of the things you're doing behind the scenes and the spy craft or the self-protection that kind of dies out of the 60s. And it's not necessarily beyond gadgets, something that's really put forward. And I've always found that to be just an incredibly interesting aspect. But the figure of Bond himself has become an archetype of what spy culture is and could, should, would be. But I also think the women in the Bond film have become this archetype for what women are supposed to be and the role that sex plays in spy culture, whether or not these agents consent or want to consent, it's part of their job. And I find that to be a bit of a dist a bit, a lot of a disturbing component, because for women spies, that tends to be really pronounced. If you have to be attractive, you have to do the seduction, you have to have sex. This is your power. This is your way forward. But rarely do you have that question of consent. And there's an interesting movie. I looked at Maggie Q's work, and there's a movie that she did. I think it was a Hong Kong movie called Naked Weapon, in which she and a whole bunch of young women are, I don't know if they're kidnapped or they're exiled, and they're all trained as spies, and then they have to kind of kill each other. But their like initiation is that they're drugged and that they're gang raped, and that's their initiation into sex and sexuality, and then they use sex in their spy craft. And I remember sitting there watching, being like, what is this? Like, this is how women against sexual violence is being utilized to then unleash this as like a skill. Like, this isn't a video game. This isn't like a skill set that you're just like magically ticking off because of trauma. But I find it interesting that the way that sex is this currency, it's this power in spy culture. And it just doesn't make me comfortable because what if you don't want to sleep with the person? But if you don't, and you see that in the Bond films, like even if you don't want to sleep with Bond, you'll probably die because your boss will kill you. Like, or he'll kill you because you don't. Like, you're really kind of like there, you have no out. Someone like Miss Taro in Dr. No, right? Dr. No will kill her if she doesn't sleep with Bond. She knows something's up, but Bond is going to harm her if she doesn't. She doesn't look like she wants to. That always makes me feel uncomfortable because if you have to use force for sex to happen, then you don't have sexual charisma. You have sexual violence. You're not this charismatic woman, not womanizing, but you know, when women like moths to a flame, that you have this charisma, magnetism, that's the word I'm trying to get to. But if you have to impose power and utilize sexual violence, you don't have sexual magnetism. Yeah.
Although they don't have to be polar opposites, think of the stories of young women and hysteria watching the Beatles or lots of other rock acts, and the stories we now know of statutory rape. I don't know whether by the Beatles, but by lots of other acts, where yes, women are weeping with pleasure and screaming and wanting to meet these guys, but then are raped. So yes, they might have sexual magnetism. They might have sexual charisma. They might also be sexually violent. And I guess this is part of the problem with Bond. So, in all of this, what makes you stay with them, with these films? What is of interest compared to your audio listening interests, which are more, things written by women, for women, with female protagonists? What keeps you rolling along with Jimbo?
Good question. So, I mean, I grew up watching the films with my dad. My dad passed away a couple of years ago, and I actually haven't watched a Bond film since. So it was this connection with us, this piece of nostalgia. And I don't think anything made I made him very proud in life. There are a lot of things that I've done, but anytime I've done something critiquing and working with James Bond, you could see that extra level of pride. And so I love my dad. But I always felt that there was more that I had to say. And again, there's nostalgia that's built into it. I love the action and the adventure components, but at the same time, I want something more as I grow up and as I look to the content that I'm choosing to listen to and not critique, which I'm doing for pleasure, and the ones that I'm critiquing, let's say for work. And every time I think I'm done with Bond, where I'm like I'm done, I think I've done it. There are more opportunities for me to engage and really learn about myself through it. What is it that attracts me to it? What is it that inspired me? I mean, the movie Octopussy inspired me as a kid. I saw these young women who were independent, who were fighting for themselves and living on an island. I found that inspirational. Between that and Princess Leia, those were my heroes growing up. There is value in these texts, and sometimes you have to find your heroes where they're located, but it doesn't mean I have to swallow wholesale the entire context of the film and all the key elements. And I think what I want to do is create an awareness that it's not either or. You can still like certain elements, you can dislike certain elements, but that's up to you. You know, fandom is an individualized experience, but we're in this all or nothing culture where you can't say anything bad. If you critique at all, then you must hate it or you're not a true fan. And I don't believe in that type of binaristic thinking and those extremes. And I am really, through my work, trying to chart a middle ground and make my work accessible as possible so that academics will read it, but cinephiles will also read it, and that I can talk about it on podcasts and with friends. I was on the James Bond and Friend podcast for many years, where I could bring these insights to a broader listenership and show them that there's just a different way and a different form of engagement. And I want to help them have these conversations in a way that is safe for them. Because, I was saying to you before, like, I don't like echo chambers. I gain nothing from echo chambers. I want a good conversation. I like having my views challenged, and I like challenging others in a way that's respectful, by the way, not yelling at each other. We don't have to agree on everything, but that's how I learn. I learn from difference.
Prof, I wonder if I could ask you two final questions,
Okay.
and then invite you to conclude things by adding anything to what you've said. Might be returning to topics we've mentioned, might be something entirely different. Does that sound all right as a way of finishing up?
Absolutely.
So, my first question is to ask you about the theoretical influences on you. In your scholarship, but also in your ways of looking at films and television programs.
It's interesting. My jumping into film. I never went to school for film, if that's, I think that's the best way of putting it. I came to my understanding of film from a sociological perspective, understanding gender, doing the work myself. So reading film textbooks. I had this thing where I was doing my PhD and I was watching a film a night. I realized I didn't have the type of library background. So much of it has come from individual understanding. And that means that when I engage with different theorists, I am not simply repeating what I've been taught, what other people have emphasized for me. I'm able to go in and try to pick out oftentimes the elements in scholarship that might get overlooked, right? What are the other elements and other nuggets? So I don't have one particular theory or approach that I subscribe to. And over the years, as I've taught in social justice programs, which, if you look at any social justice work, it is a multiplicity of voices. The whole point is to have a multiplicity and a diversity of voices. It's really about, for me, engaging in a way that is open and inclusive and expanding my understanding, which is why my work in Bond is always going to continue to evolve because I'm constantly opening my eyes and moving things forward. So I don't think I have a set approach. I don't have sort of my go-to theorists that I go to. And I don't really want to have that. I like the flexibility of being a person who is in between. I like to, just to tell you, like, my undergrad was in arts and sciences from McMaster, and it's an interdisciplinary program where we were writing essays in math class and we were doing stats in our English classes. Like, it was about teaching you about the spaces in between and the commonality. And it's given me an opportunity to connect with scholars working in really interesting fields and being able to bring in with me my voices and my approaches, but learning through them their voices and their approaches. And that is, I like the fact that I can't pin it down. I like being able to just kind of find the spaces and the gaps and fill them. And I was told by a scholar once upon a time when we were talking about like Chinese language cinemas, he's like, Lisa, there's so much room for you here. Just sit down, spread out. And that has actually been my scholarly approach. Where are the gaps? How do I put together projects, bring together a diversity of voices. The more diversity, the better. And how do we all kind of come together and put to this synergistic collection together and then move on to the next gap and the next gap? And I find that that type of approach, I've had the most interesting conversations engaging with people that have done collections with me. And that to me is the valuable scholarly work, is with them as they are creating and shaping their voices, helping them walk along. So I don't think I fully answered your question, but that's kind of where I like to sit in ambiguous territory.
Great, thank you so much. And my last question, Prof, before throwing to you, is to ask you about national cinemas, because you've done this work, a couple of books, I guess now. I think I know the first one, but not the most recent one, looking at different incarnations of this particular figure in different countries or influences of this figure in different countries. And the Bond producers get lots of British money by pretending that they're making a British film, while, of course, it's a co-production in the US sense, which is different from the way other countries regard co-productions. And There are lots of highly supported cinemas like Canadian that justify the amount of public subvention they get by the need to resist Hollywood in particular by telling, in this case, Canadian stories to Canadians. Frequently, the criticism of this kind of national cinema is it's only some kinds of stories about some kinds of people that get told. National cinema means men's cinema. In settler colonies, it means white cinema, and so on and so on. So I wondered about the state of debate and your thoughts about national cinema versus something that is clearly transnational, like the 007 films.
It's interesting when we talk about Canadian cinema in this way. And this is a, I have never fully, I'm just articulating this off the cuff. And I've just returned to Canada after 10 years in the States. It's interesting because I've never really thought of Canadian cinema as Canadian cinema per se, because we are such a multicultural and I would say multinational, culture. You know, I consider our First Nations to be nations in and of themselves. So when you talk about what constitutes national cinema, I'm kind of like, what national cinemas are you talking about? There are a lot of First Nations filmmakers. I know that there are many scholars in Canada working particularly in studying their work. There's many different festivals and so on and so forth. I think Canada is interesting because we are considered Hollywood of the North at the same time. And so there is this huge push for Vancouver, Toronto. I live in Hamilton, and Hamilton does house many different productions, and it's always interesting to see your city and your landmarks on TV shows. We get a lot of money by being a hub for US money and talent, and there's a big push in Canada to include Canadian actors and Canadian talent on those productions instead of just bringing up, say, US filmmakers. And so I don't feel it's fully defined, because we are, if you consider our talent being utilized, then it's a transnational production and not a US production. You've got a lot of more independent cinema happening here, but the question is, who's leading these productions? And so, yeah, I think, you know, I just think Canadian nationalism is a very interesting concept that is not fully defined as to what it is and how people feel about it. I think it means many things to many people, and I think our cultural industry is a reflection of that. So that's my winding way of trying to think about this when I haven't fully given it a thought before this particular moment.
I'm not sure you're a full supporter of Hockey Night in Canada. I don't think Don Cherry is your guiding star. I've got some concerns about the direction of this conversation.
Here's the thing. Okay, so I've already outed myself as not being a reader. I don't like hockey. Okay. Like, I am the worst Canadian. I mean, technically now I'm a dual citizen, so maybe that's just, you know, living in the States for a decade, but I'm not the biggest fan of hockey. I will watch like the Canada team and specifically the women's team. I will support, I'll support our athletes, but like, am I gonna sit home on any night watching hockey? The answer is no. So it's not my sport, and I feel like maybe I'm alone. Maybe please don't send any mail to me. I know. I won't read it apparently. I don't read. So
Well, you know, it's interesting. One of my interviewees in the podcast was Rick Gruneau, and Rick is, you know, Mr. Ca Hockey Night in Canada academically and so on, but very critical of hockey, and I think one could say almost having lost his love for it, if you can. So there it is. But no, I was right in thinking to myself, I wonder if she's Ms. Don Cherry, and I doubt it somehow. And a good thing, too, one might add. So, Prof, I wonder if we could bring things to a close by your stepping in now and choosing a topic or topics, as I say, that might be ones we've already covered where you want to add something, or might be something that we haven't touched on where you want to make some remarks.
question for you. I'm going to put you on the spot. How did that work? Is that part of the deal here? Okay, why did you choose me for your podcast? You are interviewing so many notable scholars. What was it about my work that interested you to have a chat with me? Because I've thoroughly enjoyed this, but I'm just wondering.
Well, I guess I had heard some years ago you on one of those podcasts you mentioned, and I got a bit bored, not by you, but by the boys, and I stopped listening, to tell you the truth, because there's nothing wrong with being a fanboy, but I just got a bit bored, which I can easily do. This is not a It sounds like a criticism of them. I can't even remember their names if I ever knew them, but I did get a wee bit bored, but not by what you said, and it interested me. And I have read much of your work and learnt from it, and so I wanted to chat to you for that reason.
Thank you. It's interesting when you are the only academic voice on a podcast and then the only woman academic voice on a podcast. And I would always take those opportunities to interject as much as possible. Like if people are listening, I want it to be that voice to say, hey, there's another way to think about it. There's another perspective. And I would never be a stand-in for all academics working on Bond. There's a lot of us. Or be a voice for all women, because that's just not how I roll. But it was great to have a platform, specifically in COVID, when people were really looking and hungry for anything at that time, to be able to share with them a different way of looking at things. And I see that as being an opportunity. And I also saw this as being a great opportunity for us to connect and for me to share my unique approach to scholarship and my unique worldviews and some of my quirks. So I really appreciate you bringing me on to chat about it. This was the highlight of my week. Like, this was great.
Thank you so much. It's greatly appreciated. And now I know you've got a full day of decanal service ahead of you. I just hope that the weekend can bring some good audiobook experiences.
It will.
Many, many thanks, Prof.
Thank you.